This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, radical politics at home and abroad.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on.
You know, few people understand what this song is really about. Eyes on the Prize, written in the 1950s from a hymn from the early 20th century. If you go back to 1963, when this song was recorded by Pete Seeger during the year of the historic March on Washington, you see people wearing posters calling for jobs and economic opportunity. You hear speeches about corporate America, workers' rights, pay equity for the working class. This hour, how the old civil rights movement may have lost its radical economic message, and one place in America that still has its eyes on that prize. A lot of people listening to us on Georgia Public Radio know exactly what I'm talking about. You're a part of that history. Whether you are or not, we want to welcome those listeners out there in Atlanta and the state of Georgia to The Takeaway this week. But first, radical politics in Egypt and Brazil and how religion figures into unrest on the streets. In a moment, we'll check in on the interim military government openly cracking down now on the Muslim Brotherhood and not worried about wider repercussions. But we begin with the millions of people in Brazil who took time out from weeks of unrest in that country, people who've been demanding economic justice on the streets of Rio and São Paulo, people who clamored to hear the message of peace from visiting Pope Francis. Following his visit, the Pope made some unexpected and conciliatory remarks about homosexuality as well. For more on all of this, Rachel Donadio joins us. She's in the Rome Bureau. She's the Rome Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Rachel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a very important overseas trip that's almost, maybe it is, upstaged by these remarks on the Pope's sort of conclusion of his trip to Brazil. What do you make of it?
That's true. Well, as you know, Pope Francis, on the plane back from Brazil, told reporters he pretty much reached out to gays, and he said that he isn't going to judge priests for their sexual orientation. He said, if someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge? And that's a pretty remarkable overture. It's not that he's condoning homosexuality. It's just a kind of more open approach, which is very much in keeping with the style of this Pope, who since the day he was elected in March has been much more direct, open, conciliatory, pastoral, and really trying to build bridges.
Is there surprise in this remarks? Is it consistent with the kind of conciliatory gestures that were throughout his trip to Brazil?
Yeah, I really think so. I mean, in Brazil, he got, as I could tell from watching this on the media, like all of you, that he was received extremely warmly. He got almost a rock star following. People trying to mob his Pope mobile at first, which caused some security hiccups. But he's just really seen as someone who's reaching out. I don't think he's fundamentally changing the teachings of the Catholic Church at all. But sometimes in a moment when a lot of people are suffering, when the economic crisis has really upended a lot of people's lives, he's seen as someone who is just kind of there for people. He was seen hugging drug addicts at a center in Brazil. I mean, it's rare that you just see a Pope kind of hugging someone. Not since John Paul, really, has a Pope been this well received. Benedict, his more intellectual theologian predecessor, is probably going to be remembered as one of the great theologians of the, of his era, but wasn't such a warm and fuzzy guy.
Let's explore that comparison with Pope John Paul, and you made the point there. John Paul really engaged politically in his confrontations with the Soviet Union and even afterwards. It seems to me that Pope Francis is calling for, or at least is evoking, a kind of moratorium from politics, the idea that we can put politics aside for a moment and all just try to live together. That seems to be the message in Brazil.
Yeah, I think it's a very kind of humanistic message like that. He made some comments against political corruption, which I think resonated well with people in Brazil, where, as you know, there have been lots of protests, people angry that the cost of living has gone up so much and their salaries haven't. And, this Pope has made very targeted remarks about world financial markets, which he sees as really destroying people's lives and standards of living. I mean, it's not so much a kind of purely anti-capitalistic message, but it's a message that, people are affected by markets, which to me seems to be one of the most political things that he has said since becoming Pope.
talking to Rachel Donadio, Rome bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. So back to the comment on gays that the Pope made. If someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge, says Pope Francis. Many more questions about what the implications are for that. Not a whole lot of questions, though, about his views regarding women in the priesthood.
Well, right. He said that John Paul had kind of definitively closed the door on that. There aren't going to be women in the priesthood, but he's called for a greater role for women in the church, a more of an engagement of women. He talked, I think it was about a theology of women. I'm not quite sure what he means by that, but pretty much women are not going to be priests, but that doesn't mean that they can't play an important role in the church. Now, as for his comments about gays, he was asked about reports of a gay lobby inside the Vatican. And by gay lobby, that just means a bunch of prelates who might be gay kind of blackmailing, using that information about some of their other colleagues for blackmail purposes. And that's when Francis responded saying, you know, a lobby like that would be an issue, but I pretty much don't have anything against gays themselves. Who am I to judge?
So it both confronts and attempts to diffuse a potential political issue within the Vatican, as well as making a broad sort of global commentary on morality and sexuality.
That's true. And you have to remember that Francis was elected pope after Benedict's papacy had become embroiled in so many different scandals, the famous Vatileak scandal of leaked documents, also alleging homosexual behavior among some priests inside the Vatican. And so Francis was really brought in to try to kind of rein in a Vatican bureaucracy that's been seen as really corrupt and insular. One of the things that Francis keeps hammering home on is that it's important for the Catholic Church to be in dialogue with the rest of the world. That means that the Vatican should not be so insular. It should respond to the needs of the world, and that the Catholic Church should also engage. And that was a theme that he discussed a lot in his trip to Brazil as well.
Rachel Donadio, Rome bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, John.
Now to Egypt. Over the weekend, Egyptian authorities opened fire on Muslim Brotherhood protesters in Cairo, leaving more than 70 dead. The Brotherhood's political future in doubt. The overall intentions of the interim government a real mystery now. Joining us is Samer Shahada, associate professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let me just say that based on the events of the last few days, and particularly over the weekend, it appears that the Egyptian public, broadly speaking, is willing to tolerate an all-out offensive against the Muslim Brothers. Is that your read?
Yes, I think that is correct, with the caveat that some percentage of the Egyptian public has accepted a narrative that the Brotherhood is engaged in terrorism and violence and is willing to tolerate the regime's use of force, excessive use of force, in the opinion of many, against the organization and its supporters, even if they are protesting peacefully. Now, what needs to be said is, of course, there has been a media and a psychological war really taking place over the last month or so against the movement that has largely been consumed by much of the public in this highly polarized setting.
The thing that puzzles me, though, is that they did win an election, but their record of governing was dreadful. And it seems to me that record discredits them enough. What do you make of the terrorism charges? Are they believable, or does the interim government need this to really go after the brothers?
Well, I think that if you ask any serious student of the Muslim Brotherhood, the terrorism charges are not believable. The Brotherhood renounced violence in the 1960s and hasn't been engaged in violence as an organization since then. Now, it needs to be said, however, that there are fringe movements, there are other Islamist groups not affiliated with the Brotherhood in the Sinai and elsewhere, who are engaging in violence against the security forces, against the police, in some cases against minorities and so on. And in that context, and again, in the highly polarized, highly charged world of Egyptian politics over the last months, with the psychological warfare that many of the media privately owned stations and now the government stations have been engaged in against the Muslim Brotherhood, yes, there are those who are consuming and believing this kind of hysteria, in fact.
So I guess what concerns me now is that it appears that very, very broadly, the people of Egypt believe that the only way the economy is going to turn around, the only way tourists come back, the only way trade in the Suez Canal restarts and the revenues begin flowing, short of, you know, Saudi bailouts and American bailouts for that matter, is a return to a kind of martial law, albeit with some sort of democratic process going forward. But is it a kind of nostalgia that's going on in addition to an attempt to crack down on the streets?
No, there's not a nostalgia. And I think it needs to be stated that there are some, we don't know how many, but some of those who supported the June 30th protests and the July 3rd coup or coup by popular demand and so on, who have no interest in going back to the Mubarak days of an authoritarian state with heavy state security presence and regular violation of human rights. And we're going to see what transpires in the future. It certainly is the case that there are elements of the old Mubarak regime in the security forces, in the interior ministry, in the police and so on, who have reemerged, as well as some political players, who want to set the clock back to before Mr. Mubarak was ousted and have a police force interact with the public in that manner with no accountability and total impunity. Now, I think what we're going to likely see in the coming period is a struggle between, you know, revolutionary forces who want a new Egypt based on human rights and political freedoms and so on, and parts of the state and the security forces who have a completely different vision, as you intimated, one of martial law and complete free hand to deal with protesters and political dissidents.
You're describing a kind of super nostalgia for Gamal Abdel Nasser, which would go back to the 1950s. More than 70 dead in the protests over the weekend. Are people in Egypt just basically numbed to the bloodshed? I mean, there were hundreds killed during the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. I'm surprised that this carnage hasn't produced the same kind of backlash.
Well, I think it needs to be understood that, and this is quite terrifying, that there has been a process of kind of othering that has been going on. In other words, the society is so polarized, one can think of it as almost two Egypts. I mean, you're either in the Egypt that believes the narrative of the military officers and so on and others that this group is a terrorist organization and that they need to be eradicated. And therefore, the violence becomes acceptable. And the violence then is blamed on them for provocations and so on. Or you're in the other Egypt, much smaller Egypt, in which this is a coup, the violence is excessive, this is a counter-revolution, and Morsi should be the president still, and so on. So that type of othering really makes the violence acceptable in the view of some, unfortunately.
Samer Shahada is Associate Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
For the past year, Frontline and ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson been investigating fatal lapses in care throughout the industry with a focus on the for-profit chain Emeritus Senior Living. Thompson's film, Life and Death in Assisted Living, airs on PBS tomorrow night.
Well, there's about 750,000 people living in assisted living now, and mostly these are folks who can't live on their own anymore. They need some help. They need maybe some supervision, a little bit of medical attention, but they don't want to live in a place that's like a nursing home that feels like a hospital, feels institutional. And assisted living is providing an alternative to that that's more like being in an apartment with some people around to help you get through the day. And what we've seen is a massive explosion in the for-profit part of this industry as it's become a big business and more of these companies have moved onto Wall Street to become publicly traded. And what we're seeing is a real, real intense drive by the big players in this operation and the big players in this industry to achieve the highest occupancy goals possible, like a hotel chain, that they want as many people in their buildings as possible.
In Emeritus's case, if you go into an Emeritus facility, thinking about their brand for a moment, what would I see? What would it look like? What's the decor? What's the sort of sensibility?
You know, these facilities look great. They look immaculate. The problem is that when you get inside these buildings, what you find out is that that appearance is not always backed up by great care, by trained caregivers, or by staff that are really always dedicated to the best interests of the residents there.
And amidst this very homey sort of visual environment, you tell a story of George McAfee, who was a star football player for the Chicago Bears back in the 40s and 50s, but had a horrible experience at an emeritus facility. Listen.
His face almost looked like what you picture in a horror story of a death mask. And I hope that he wasn't aware of what was going on, but we certainly were afraid that he was just in horrific pain because he would almost try to sit up.
Well, one time he did sit up.
He did sit up.
And opened his eyes. Yes.
And we said, Daddy, we're right here.
Those relatives there describing the horrific consequences of a moment of negligence at an emeritus facility where George McAfee got his hands on some poisonous cleaning fluid and essentially it resulted in his death in the worst possible way. How is this emblematic of how assisted living facilities, and emeritus in particular, might be over their heads in the kind of medical needs of the populations they're attracting?
You know, when we speak to emeritus, they say, look, these are isolated incidents. Why are you picking out these things from a few years ago that were tragic and sad? This is not how our company operates. The problem is that we looked all over the country. We looked at more than 100 lawsuits. We looked at thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of state inspection records. And what we found was that there were incidents like this occurring over and over and over again. There were the people that walked out of emeritus buildings. They had dementia and they wandered off and died. One woman froze to death on Christmas morning. There are the people who have fallen from windows. We found two different people who had dementia and for one reason or another apparently tried to get out of second story windows and fell to their deaths. You know, that would seem like an outlier, but it happened more than once. And we found that pretty quickly. Here are people that have really serious health needs. They have Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia. They need people who are well-trained and very competent to oversee them and help with their care. And in case after case, people working in emeritus facilities did not have the legally required training to work with residents with Alzheimer's and dementia. And just to make it clear, those requirements are not very strict in most states. So for California, for example, you only need 6 hours of training to work with a resident with Alzheimer's or dementia. Yet we were finding that emeritus facilities, their workers didn't have that legally required training. And in fact, sometimes the administrators running these memory care facilities for emeritus didn't have the legally required training.
Well, here's the response from Granger Cobb, who's the CEO of Emeritus Corporation, who you speak with in this documentary.
When you're dealing with this many residents, particularly a population that can have unpredictable behavior or is frail and is kind of a high-risk population to begin with, we will have situations from time to time, but they're the vast minority. I mean, it is really the exception to the rule.
Do you find that to be an acceptable response, or do you think that emeritus is really overmatched in dealing with the kind of population that it has in its facilities, even given the light regulations that exist right now for assisted living?
This is a company that's incredibly sophisticated. They have really great IT infrastructure. They can track things going on in all of their roughly 500 buildings across the country. Yet their top nurse says, I can't ensure that everyone in our company has the legally required training. And, you know, I should make it clear, we saw similar problems that we found at Emeritus in other facilities and at other companies. But in a lot of ways, Emeritus is emblematic of this industry and where the industry is going. Here's the problem. There is no real good consumer market mechanism to ensure that people are getting quality care in these facilities. In a lot of states, you can't get a lot of information about what a track record is for a facility. And so consumers are in the dark in a lot of states. And then on the other hand, there isn't a really good government mechanism to ensure that these companies are following the rules in lots of states. In California, The inspections happen about every 5 years, the routine inspections. That's a long time to go between inspections to make sure that everything's happening. So at this point, I don't think there's a great mechanism either through the market or through the state to ensure that people are getting treated decently in these facilities.
A.C. Thompson is a reporter for ProPublica. His documentary for Frontline, which is produced by WGBH, is called Life and Death in Assisted Living. The film airs tomorrow night on PBS. ProPublica is also running a multi-part text series with A.C. Thompson's reporting on their website all week long. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And we all need help sometimes. Someone looking out for us, crossing the streets. Even in the kitchen, a comforting voice of someone looking over your shoulder when you're making breakfast.
May I have your attention, please? Eggs are meant to be cracked on the left side of the bowl, not the right. Please pay attention and follow directions so that eggs may enter the batter in the correct manner.
Or in the backyard, starting up the grill.
Your attention, please. When starting a fire, please be careful about using accelerants. Halt. The accelerant used could come back and explode.
You know these guys. They are there with you. Voice angels of the airport, the train station, the subway, anywhere.
Welcome to New York Kennedy International Airport.
Ticketed passengers only beyond the checkpoint.
They barely need an introduction as voices, but they are real people. Jack Fox and Carolyn Hopkins. Jack joins us from WFPL in Louisville, and Carolyn joins us from WMEH in Bangor, Maine.
We are looking over your shoulder in every airport that you travel, John.
We try.
Making sure that you stand to the right on the moving sidewalk so others who wish to pass can do so safely on the left.
Oh, my gosh, that gives me kind of smiley creeps to hear you just sort of say that, isn't it? So how do you inject humanity into this unique job that you do?
In my case, I really do think about the person I'm talking to.
So I picture somebody getting on the moving sidewalk or afraid to park their car, and it helps.
And who auditioned you for these jobs, and what kinds of things did they say when you went in for the original recordings? Carolyn?
They said, it needs to be a friendly Disneyland kind of voice. And I said, okay, let me try it. And, you know, like, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. From that point on, that's how it worked. I don't remember when you started, Jack.
I was at a radio station here in Louisville and had done a lot of voiceover work there at the place where you were working. That's where we knew each other.
Have you ever been in a public place, Carolyn, and had to listen to your grammatical error?
I wasn't expecting to hear myself in Orange County, John Wayne International Airport out in California. I just had forgotten that we had done that, Jack, and all of a sudden, boom, and I went, oh.
My weirdest time was flying from Louisville to Phoenix once, and it was an early morning flight, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm standing in the men's room, and my voice is booming at me. That's kind of weird, you know?
What were you saying to yourself in the men's room?
Not to smoke, claim your, make sure that all luggage is claimed on time, that sort of thing. Pretty generic, but it was a shocker at 7 o'clock in the morning.
It's kind of strange. What do your children, grandchildren, relatives, friends think of all this before we go?
At an airport once waiting for a rental car, my voice was telling people to claim their luggage every 2 minutes. And my granddaughter, who was about 4 at the time, looked at her mother and said, why is Grandpa talking so much?
How about you, Carolyn?
Well, my husband was waiting for me outside on the curb. And this was prior to 9/11. And the guard came up to him and said, sir, don't you hear that voice? You need to move your car. And he said, why? I don't listen to that voice at home. Why should I do it here?
Oh, that's amazing. Jack Fox and Carolyn Hopkins are the voices behind announcements at over 100 airports around the world, the New York City subway, and right here on The Takeaway.
This interview is ending now.
Please watch your step.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
So let's say there's something you want to change about the way people are taxed, laws you want rewritten. Let's say you're a member of Congress and you agree to vote for change, but only under condition that what you say in debates, what amendments you propose, all kept secret, not just until the law is passed, but for the next 50 years. Sounds like some weird ritual you'd expect in a monastery or a reason to impeach a member of Congress, but it's real. Actually, it's close enough to real to maybe scare us a little bit. Friday was the actual deadline for lawmakers to submit their secret preferences for tax loopholes they want to keep. The Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Todd, this is one for the books.
It is, John. And what Senator Max Baucus and Senator Orrin Hatch have told senators on the Finance Committee is we're going with a thing called a blank slate. We are wiping the tax code clean of all loopholes. We're going to pretend they don't exist. And it's up to you, senators on the Finance Committee, to come to us and tell us which ones you want to keep in. Why the secrecy? Because any senator that says, I think we should keep in a loophole for ethanol, I think we should keep in a loophole for mortgages, well, they're going to have lots and lots of lobbyists from the other side coming to tear them down, and they all know it, John.
But these are reasonable loopholes. I mean, some would call them, you know, rational deductions to produce incentives of one kind or another. Why the secrecy unless it is the, you know, gold faucets and private jets, that sort of thing?
Well, listen to Congressman Earl Blumenauer. He's on the Tax Writing Committee in the House. And one thing I noticed very quickly is that the House members, the counterparts who write the tax laws, all think this is a pretty strange idea, but they understand it. Listen to Blumenauer.
It's an admission of how complex the challenge is and how fraught with deep and intense politics. I mean, everything's in the code for a reason. And people are fiercely protective.
I've got to know what Mr. Earmarks himself, John McCain, must have thought about this. Did you manage to catch up with him?
I did. Now, John McCain isn't on the Tax Writing Committee, but John McCain has spent a career railing against special tax loopholes in public. He doesn't agree with this 50-year business, and of course, he's not on the committee, so he doesn't have to worry about it. Listen to McCain.
I've said all that publicly many, many times, so to have a secret message that will not be made public till 2080. Yeah, come on. I don't know what they're thinking.
There's McCain.
Much. That's too much. I mean, yeah. I just love that. Anybody supporting this? Anybody think this will actually move things along? This is a pretty huge task.
Well, you know, Blumenauer sort of said he didn't need this kind of secrecy, but he understood why the secrecy was needed because maybe it allows senators to blue sky, to throw out ideas without worrying about tax lobbyists and other special interests, especially those 501c4s maybe going to run an ad against you without them coming down on your shoulders. Keep in mind, the secrecy that they're proposing is just in the committee. Eventually, all this stuff will get voted on the floor, but the senators Hatch and Baucus say they're just trying to give senators a little bit of breathing room. Now, listen to Congressman Dave Reichert. He's also on the Tax Writing Committee. He's a Republican from Washington in the House, and he thinks the secrecy is a bad idea. He says, in the House, we don't do this. We do everything by the light of day. But listen to what he said when I ask him, okay, Mr. Light of Day, which tax loopholes do you think should go?
Every loophole, every shelter, tax shelter, it's all on the table. It's still up for discussion.
You don't have one that you know,
well,
Reichert,
is,
that
no,
that needs
no,
to go?
No. I think that when you start to do this, when you take one out and you just say this is the one and it has to go, then what happens is, of course, it has tentacles that hang onto a lot of other pieces of the tax code.
Maybe those tentacles are on K Street and they produce campaign commercials against lawmakers, huh?
And that's part of the problem. You're talking about so much money. And yes, there are the funny tax loopholes that everybody hates with sugar and agriculture and all those ones that you can think of, corporate jets from days of old. But John, like I said, most of this stuff have major, major industries and stuff that you might like. Mortgage interest deduction, education deductions, capital gains. Here's a big one that Wall Street likes. How about carried interest, where people who make their money on investments instead of regular income pay the 15% rate while you and I pay 25%? That's worth trillions, and they're not going to let it go easily.
Well, I'd love to be in the National Archives to look in this little box between now and 2080 or whenever it is, if only to entertain John McCain. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Hold on. legendary Mavis Staples singing one of the anthems of what we think of today as the Civil Rights Movement. But what was the prize that hundreds of thousands of people from all walks of life had their eyes on 50 years ago? The people from all over America who were part of the March on Washington that culminated in the immortal pictures of protest, democracy, and racial equality. What was the prize they were willing to drop everything to come at their own expense to the nation's capital and demand that they were willing to face police, the FBI, and the entire U.S. government to obtain?
Nor is the goal of our civil rights revolution merely the passage of civil rights legislation. Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens, but those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them. Yes, we want a Fair Employment Practice Act, but what good will it do if profit-geared automation destroys the jobs of millions of workers, black and white?
For labor activists, you can hear him there, A. Philip Randolph, the March on Washington was the culmination of more than two decades of confronting American economic inequality. Even though we remember the March on Washington for the soaring poetry of Martin Luther King's dream of racial justice, it is economic justice that remains the elusive prize. William Jones is the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. He's professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Jones, welcome.
Thank you very much, John. It's great to be here.
So remind us of A. Philip Randolph. He was such a central figure in 1963, barely remembered today.
That's right. If you look at the publicity for the March on Washington, Life magazine, for example, carried a picture of A. Philip Randolph on its cover right after the march. He was the official director of the march. He had, as you mentioned, first called for a March on Washington in 1941. He was widely known as the dean of the civil rights movement at the time. And it would not be until later, actually until after the assassination of Martin Luther King, that Martin Luther King and his I Have a Dream speech would be primarily identified as the message of the march.
Until then, there's this unity of civil rights and this challenge to American capitalism that I think gets lost in our understanding of what happened in 1963, but certainly was part of what made people so nervous about that march in Washington in August of 1963.
That's right. When, A. Philip Randolph, when he first called for the march in 1941, was routinely blasted in the news media. He was called the most dangerous Negro in America. And he retained something of that reputation in the 1960s. He was a prominent figure in the Socialist Party and in the labor movement, and identified as a radical.
Did an economic coalition that really was building across the country as you got to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, did that fall apart? Was it sort of grafted away or surgically removed to support this sort of pure vision of racial justice, the civil rights movement as we remember today, all of the economic reforms sort of forgotten after the march?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that's our memory, but I don't think that's actually an accurate way in which people would have perceived it at the time. In fact, the most important demand of the march for most of the people who participated in it was the creation of what at the time was known as a Fair Employment Practices Law, making it illegal to discriminate against somebody on the basis of their race or their national origin, their religion.
And that included employers and unions, right?
That's right. It covered private employers and unions. So it was at this time it was seen as a very radical move. And that became Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and was really, I think, probably the central achievement of the march, to take a law that had actually already been introduced by Kennedy 2 months before the march. But Kennedy did not support the Fair Employment Law. It later became known as the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. And that, I think, you know, that still remains a really important part of our legal framework.
You know, you quote Hubert Humphrey as saying that he didn't believe, and there were a lot of skeptical lawmakers in Washington in August of 1963, that even Hubert Humphrey didn't believe many votes were changed on the Civil Rights Act. It took the assassination of JFK and the mobilization by Lyndon Johnson to get a Civil Rights Act. But I'm wondering if the economic reforms in the war on poverty, aside from the Fair Employment Practices Act that you've described, really fade into the distance, and we're not having the same debates today.
Well, again, I would point to the war on poverty. Probably the most important legacy of the war on poverty was Medicare and Medicaid, which had a tremendous impact on lowering poverty rates in the 1970s and 1980s. And, you know, we are having a debate over a national health care system. I don't think that those things were forgotten, but I do think we forget that they were part of the civil rights agenda.
The Reagan Revolution, I think, enshrines American capitalism with the idea of being equal to freedom, and that was not understood that way in 1963.
That's right. The principle, I think the idea that jobs came first, it was jobs and freedom, and the idea was that that in order to be equal, you have to have a decent standard of living and also not be competing with other people who feel their standard of living is threatened.
William Jones is the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. He's also a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up, more on economic justice and the modern civil rights movement. What prize do you have your eyes on? Kimberly from Texas writes, "Thumbs up. I am living the American dream. I own a business. I don't have enough money to do everything I want, but I have the opportunity to earn it. I can vote, and I do what I can to make my community a better place for all." But Tyrone says, "No, I'm not living it. I'm trying to get to it. Ever since getting laid off in 2007, and this is the Great Recession of 2008, it's been an uphill battle ever since." He's one of you from Baltimore. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/TheTakeaway. This is The Takeaway. Stay with us. Hold on. Hold on. Nowhere is the goal of economic justice and equality more unmet, the promise of economic opportunity in America unkept, than in the community of Youngstown, Ohio. Once a center of American manufacturing, it lost its steel factories in the 70s, and in a second wave of plant closings, lost its remaining manufacturing in the 1990s. While the March on Washington was motivated on trying to make sure everyone shared in the American prosperity of the 20th century, perhaps the new prize is making sure America doesn't simply forget about people displaced by an economy that has been in flux since the recession of 2008. Activist and organizer Tammy Thomas Miles walks in the footsteps of A. Philip Randolph. Today she uses the techniques of political engagement and advocacy to carry on a struggle of radical change that most Americans would dismiss today as impossible. For Tammy, the March on Washington is not a dream, it's essential. Democracy's ultimate prize, and she means to get it.
It's very hard to have a conversation about the economy and not talk about race. It's very hard to talk about one without the other, because oftentimes the folks that are left at the bottom when industries move out and jobs leave, a lot of the folks that are stuck left in those communities are usually people of color and people who live in poverty. So I think that those are bases to talk about race and gender.
In your personal story, you were a very successful factory worker, member of a union. But at a certain point, you took a step really to become an activist when most of your life told you that all you needed to do was keep your head down and everything would be fine. How did you make that transition?
Well, our company filed bankruptcy for one thing. So, you know, I'm going to be honest, I prayed about what the next step was. And then living in this community and seeing so many wrongs and so much injustice and the fact that I had to actually feel like I had to raise my kids to move away, and they did that, like that kind of stayed unsettling with me. So when I was approached with the idea of actually taking a turn to do something to actually push against people who can actually make a change or to build power amongst people who can make change in a community for themselves and not just have things done for them, it became very interesting.
The civil rights movement is something we understand in a historical context, and the civil rights leaders are often viewed as a generation that had their moment, and that moment has passed in some sense. The labor movement is dwindling in terms of numbers. Do you see your organizing as a part of the civil rights movement and a part of the union movement, or something fundamentally different, a new kind of organization, a new kind of community activism?
I see it as both, actually. I think that the work that we do in our communities on the local level, on a statewide level, and nationally, and in comparison to the civil rights movement, yes, it's about mobilization, and it is about all the work that goes on the side. The civil rights movement fight is still happening, but it's like it's happening in churches. It's happening in community centers and in backyards. And how do we make sure that that grassroots movement piece is elevated and it has a much larger voice, and it's not just one, two, or three significant key leaders?
What would you say is a harder job from your perspective? Getting the Civil Rights Act to be the law of the land back in 1965, or developing a program that's going to give felons in Youngstown, Ohio, an opportunity to work?
Oh, my gosh. That's like a loaded question, John. Well, I'll say this. We don't have dogs being sicked on us. We're not being water hosed, right? But we are being shot down in our communities. We do have stringent gun laws that are being imposed by legislators in different states across the country. And we don't have adequate access to jobs. So as far as which would be harder, you know, it's a fight in a different way. They're just being cut down in a different manner. And it is affecting the next generation after that. So I'm not sure that one fight is harder than the other. I think they're just fought in a different manner.
Do you think Youngstown will ever be prosperous again? And if so, will political activism be the agent of change? What has to happen in Youngstown?
I do think that Youngstown is turning. I don't think it's at that tipping point yet. I think that political activism has to be a part of it. But I also think that it's a coming together of folks. It's a coming together. It's an education process about how some of these issues, like voting rights, how that affects everyone. I believe that through the work that we're doing and educating folks around these issues and it being value-based, when people are looking at the next steps for Youngstown, that it becomes more important about what a person is saying and doing and holding them accountable than what political party they're coming from.
Mm.
I think it's going to be more important for churches and unions and community people and social service agencies and folks that work, you know, that are government related, that we're able to come to the table and have these discussions together, and that grassroots people are at the table where decisions are being made. I think that's how Youngstown turns around.
If there was a march on Washington today, certainly the original march on Washington was about a goal that was really clear: equality, racial equality in America. And there are all kinds of taglines and memorable phrases from that time. What would it be today, Tammy?
I think race would still be a part of it. Gender would be a part of it. But it would definitely deal with the economy, with the inequalities that exist in our economy. It would have to be a conversation that talks about flipping who's constantly winning in this country. And who's constantly winning in this country is not the everyday average person. Who's constantly winning is usually the folks that are very, very out of touch with the average, everyday, regular person.
What's the next generation going to feel about organizers, the civil rights movement, all of these politically active movements that are so much a part of our history? Is it going to mean anything to them?
I pray about that, because with this whole Trayvon Martin thing, like, I've heard these stories where kids are saying, like, you know, my life doesn't matter. I'm not valuable. But then before Trayvon Martin, you know, I would talk to seniors, and seniors were saying, you know, I don't feel like I'm valued or I don't have anything to add because my time, you know, I'm old. I would hope that the next generation sees community organizing as a way to actually bring folks of all different genders and backgrounds and ages and have these intergenerational conversations that are for them. You know, I would hope that they see that political activism is something that's directly connected to them.
Tammy Thomas Miles, senior organizer for the Mahoning Valley Organizing Collaborative and the Ohio Organizing Collaborative. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read more about the extraordinary life of Tammy Thomas Miles. She's one of the people profiled in the amazing book by journalist George Packer, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. You can catch up on this conversation, listen back to anything you hear on the show. Visit us at thetakeaway.org or find us on facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.